Welcome to Between the Lines, presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. This week we present Professor of Political Economy, Garo Perovitz, who examines the problem of rising economic inequality in the U.S. and the practical democratic solutions that have already been put into practice in communities nationwide. Lynn Freeman of the group United Wisconsin, who discusses the campaign now underway to collect enough signatures to authorize a recall election of the state's anti-union Republican governor, Scott Walker. And Jihan Nasser, a Palestinian computer technology trainer, who talks about overcoming the day-to-day obstacles encountered living under Israeli occupation. But first, we begin with a summary of some of the week's underreported news stories.
Mexico's offensive against the illegal drug trade has finally broken the peace of middle-class Mexicans who were previously untouched by the violence that has killed over 40,000 people since late 2006. Carolina Gomez, a teacher in Veracruz, Mexico, was woken up in the middle of the night by automatic weapons fire and explosions in her middle-class neighborhood. For 2 years, Gomez has come into contact with the victims of violence in the port city of Veracruz. A dead body was found near her school, and relatives of her students had been kidnapped. Yet it was not until the shootout near her apartment that Gomez felt her own security was at risk. Violence in the city exploded in 2010 as the local drug cartel splintered and one faction gained control with the aid of ex-Mexican army officers. The cartels frequently kidnap migrants and extort money from local businesses and city residents. In 2010, U.S. Secretary of State Hillary Clinton compared the drug war in Mexico to the insurgency in Colombia. But nearly every political analyst in Mexico rejects this comparison and denies there is a looming crisis in the country. Security expert Raul Benitez of the National Autonomous University in Mexico City noted, "The general population is not worried about drug trafficking. They are worried about kidnapping, extortion, and the types of activities that impact their lives." A national poll coordinated by Benitez found 61% of Mexicans surveyed said they've stopped going out at night. 30% no longer drive the state or national highways because of fear of drug trafficking violence, and 22% have quit going to public events like concerts or sporting events. Global access to clean water has become a cause that is attracting growing celebrity support and now surpasses charity assistance for HIV/AIDS research and treatment. Actor Matt Damon drew the most attention in 2011 with his nonprofit group Water.org, which uses microcredit lending to expand access to clean water in poor nations across Africa. In 2009, Damon teamed up with Gary White, who has founded his own group, H2O Africa. Water.org goes beyond providing water to African villages by leveraging water credit, enabling 300,000 people to build water wells or enabling them to obtain a clean water utility hookup. Water.org has also won the backing of funders like the PepsiCo Foundation, which has pledged $8 million to fund the project over 5 years. The tech-savvy group, simply named Charity Water, has used social media and celebrity buzz to raise money for water projects. It was founded in 2005 by Scott Harrison, a one-time Manhattan nightclub owner turned social activist. Harrison relies on private donors to pay his staff, so small online donor funds go directly to providing access to clean water. Some evangelical Christians have also recently begun to support water charities. The Christian rock group Jars of Clay has raised funds to build more than 1,000 water wells, serving over 600,000 people. According to an investigation by the Center for Public Integrity, nearly 40% of Medicare dollars spent on common cancer screenings today are medically unnecessary. Many of these life-saving tests lose their effectiveness as patients age into their late 70s and 80s. Some doctors who order these tests ignore the harm these procedures can have on frail and elderly patients. Medicare spends nearly $2 billion a year on common cancer screenings for patients in their 80s and 90s, beyond the age recommended by the U.S. Preventive Services Task Force, and some of these health recommendations are controversial, especially for breast and prostate cancer. Over 22 million mammograms, for example, are performed on women over 75 years old, the cutoff age for the test set by the Preventive Services Task Force. Most cases of breast cancer grow slowly in older women, and they are likely to die from other causes before they suffer from life-threatening effects of breast cancer. However, 38% of Medicare funds spent on breast cancer detection and treatment go to older women. This week's news summary was compiled by Bob Nixon. For Between the Lines, I'm Liz Becker.
As Republican Party presidential candidates campaigned across Iowa, the state holding the first meaningful contest for the GOP nomination, Occupy Wall Street activists in the state organized actions to focus public attention on one of their priority concerns, the corrupting influence of big money in U.S. politics. Direct action disruptions at candidate speeches and protests at headquarters, including Democratic Party offices, resulted in more than 60 arrests. The message these activists were sending was that both the Republican and Democratic parties largely represent the interests of major corporations and the top 1% wealthiest Americans. As the new year begins, many observers are pondering the future of the Occupy Wall Street movement after police evicted thousands of activists from encampments in dozens of cities nationwide. Since the emergence of Occupy activism in New York City on September 17th, one question frequently asked of the movement is, where is your agenda, and what are your specific demands? While the decentralized movement that operates by modified consensus is working through these important questions, Gar Alperovitz, author of a newly revised edition of his 2005 book, America Beyond Capitalism, Reclaiming Our Wealth, Our Liberty, and Our Democracy, offers some well-thought-out answers. Your reporter spoke with Alperovitz, the Lionel R. Bauman Professor of Political Economy at the University of Maryland, who examines the problem of rising economic inequality in the U.S. and the practical democratic solutions, many of which have already been put into practice in communities nationwide.
Systems are defined by who really has the property interests. In the feudal eras, it was the lords and manors and the aristocracy who held the landed property, and that gave them the power. In traditional capitalism, that's small individual entrepreneurial capitalism, there was a free market in small businessmen and farmers who had the capital, and that was competitive capitalism. Well, that's long since passed. You know, less than 2% of the society are farmers, and less than 7 or 8% are entrepreneurs. The big money is in corporate capitalism, and that's a different animal altogether. It's more like feudalism than it is like competitive capitalism. By the way, the people who knew that most are the theorists of free market capitalism. The great traditional Chicago School of Economics believed in free market capitalism, not corporate-dominated capitalism, which is a very anti-democratic form. Under the socialist system, the state socialist system, it was the state that had the property and had the political power. Well, if you begin with that premise, obviously a democratic society really has to decentralize and democratize in ways that are really, really democratic, the ownership of capital. And my book, America Beyond Capitalism, is a lot about the many, many examples that are building up in American society that we, in fact, are doing that and haven't quite realized it or talked about it or actually projected the implications. So let me just give you a few examples. Most people, the press doesn't cover much of this, but it doesn't take much digging to find out that there are 130 million Americans who are members of co-ops or credit unions, which are another form of co-op. Now, that's 40% of the society involved in ownership of some institution, involved with ownership of wealth, that is one person, one vote. And that's very different from the giant corporation. There are something like 13 million Americans who are involved in worker-owned companies, another form of democratic ownership or democratized ownership. There are something like 4,000 or 5,000 neighborhood corporations that exist that are designed to own property to benefit neighborhoods and communities. There are many, many examples like this. I could go on. There are 2,000 municipal-owned electric utilities. That's a city democratic kind of constitutional structure that owns wealth in a very decentralized way. By the way, 25% of American electricity is produced by municipal utilities, publicly owned, and co-ops taken together. A society obviously isn't going to be run only by co-ops and neighborhood corporations, but many of the principles that became the basis of national programs in the New Deal and in the Progressive Era, they were built up slowly, step by step, by the developments you see on the ground in which principles and ideas were established. And when the moment came, they moved into larger economic enterprise and larger policies when the New Deal came in, drawing on this experience. Justice Brandeis talked about this sort of thing as the states being the laboratories of democracy, where the new ideas began to develop in smaller form that would later take on larger form.
The Occupy Wall Street movement certainly has pointed out growing income inequality and discussing and debating and dialoguing about possible solutions, many of which I'm sure would be right along the lines of the things you've been dedicating your career to in exploring in this book, America Beyond Capitalism, and prior to. But what would be your advice to the Occupy Wall Street movement as they discuss alternatives, but maybe even more critically, are trying to think of ways, effective ways, to rein in corporate power that really blocks the implementation of progressive change that you and many other people envision?
Well, I think two things. One, you have to challenge the corporate power wherever it inhibits real politics and real action. That's at the state level very often, at the national level. And I think there's, oddly enough, the Tea Party and the occupation movement and the liberals and conservatives, many are beginning to get fed up with Wall Street bankers on both sides. And so there's going to be a reining in, or I think ultimately a takeover of some of these banks, because you really can't regulate them. They're just too big and powerful. And if you break them up, they get back together again. So that's one direction. But I would really encourage people to get involved in their own local community and look around, read my book, America Beyond Capitalism, or just check out a community-wealth website where they survey different things and see if you can begin to develop, roll up your sleeves and see if you can begin to develop some of these things that are being done in other communities to change the patterns of ownership and democratize co-ops and worker-owned companies and land trusts and neighborhood corporations. There's a lot that can be done. The third thing is study. That is to say, learn about this stuff and learn what are the implications and start doing what the founding fathers did, start thinking about the theory of where we're going and what makes sense. Those three things together, I think, give people enough power: challenging, building, but also rethinking things and not getting caught in silly ideas that are really slogans rather than thought through the developmental ideas of what to do.
That was Garo Perovitz, professor of political economy at the University of Maryland and author of the book America Beyond Capitalism, Reclaiming Our Wealth, Our Liberty, and Our Democracy. For more discussion of practical alternatives to America's political and economic status quo, visit our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. The first major backlash against extreme right-wing policies implemented by Republican officeholders elected in 2010 emerged in massive protests early last year opposing Wisconsin Governor Scott Walker's legislative effort to strip public sector unions of most of their collective bargaining rights. The pro-union protests that overwhelmed the state capitol in Madison advanced into an August 9th recall election campaign against six Republican state senators who supported Walker's agenda. Democrats won two of those races, but fell one seat short of depriving the GOP of their majority. Now dozens of labor and progressive organizations are in the midst of collecting the required 540,000 signatures needed by January 17th to authorize a recall election against Governor Walker himself. But United Wisconsin, the nonpartisan group spearheading the campaign, says they've already collected over 500,000 signatures with a goal to collect a total of 720,000 by the deadline. If the campaign validates enough signatures, a recall election with an as-yet-unknown Democratic Party candidate opposing Walker on the ballot could be scheduled before May. In addition to widespread anger over Walker's assault on public employees' unions, many in the state oppose the governor's deep cuts in education and health care programs, as well as millions of dollars in tax breaks given to Wisconsin corporations. Your reporter spoke with Lynn Freeman, a board member of the group United Wisconsin, who discusses the momentum of the recall campaign and why she believes the outcome will have consequences for national politics.
Well, we're very optimistic. We have been extremely successful. It has blown us away. The United Wisconsin, a grassroots, nonpartisan organization, we are not tied to labor. We are not tied to the Democratic Party. We have not been particularly surprised at the groundswell of support for this recall because it is what created our organization. But in 48 hours, we collected 50,000 signatures. In 2 weeks, we collected 300,000. At that point, we were averaging over 1,000 people an hour signing. And we thought that would slow down very quickly, but in fact, we maintained that pace for quite a while. And we are very optimistic that both Governor Walker and Lieutenant Governor Clefish will have to face a recall election here in the next few months. In 6 weeks, in collaboration with the Democratic Party of the state of Wisconsin and labor, we trained more than 10,000 volunteers from the state of Wisconsin to be certified petition circulators. And those folks have been out in force since November 15th collecting signatures.
When you look at public opinion in the state of Wisconsin, and I hear there's a lot of money flowing in from out of state to help Scott Walker bolster his base with a lot of television advertising, where is opinion at right now? Have there been polls talking about Scott Walker's popularity or unpopularity that gives you some hope that a recall election will win?
Oh, yeah, good question. There had been a poll done by Wisconsin Public Radio in conjunction with St. Norbert College. They're known for their political polling that they do, and they do all kinds of it. And in early summer, they had done some polling, and the numbers indicated that about 7% of Republicans wanted to see the governor recalled, and the number of people who identified themselves as Democrats who wanted to see him recalled was in the 80s at that point. The same group, St. Norbert's and Wisconsin Public Radio, did a poll again in late October, early November, and the results were stunning. Republican voters had gone from 7% supporting recall to 27% supporting recall. And the numbers of Democrats and independent voters wanting to support a recall had gone into the high 80s or low 90s. So in a fairly short amount of time, the numbers shifted dramatically. And that's the most recent polling that we've seen on that particular question. It's clear that about 56% of the electorate in the state of Wisconsin would like to see Governor Walker recalled. So we're optimistic about those numbers. Clearly, by our signature collection process, has shown that people are excited about recalling him. But again, as soon as we submit those signatures, we move into the next phase of this, which is a candidate who can run against him and then actually be elected to get him out of office. So the polling has been positive.
Lynn, how important is this fight nationally? It's obvious it's very important to people in the state of Wisconsin, but it seems that there was national coordination that included Governor Scott Walker to launch these attacks on public employees' unions all around the country where Republicans held the governor's seat and the state legislature. And it seems your recall effort really could dig the grave and bury this whole anti-union effort, at least in the short run, that was launched by very conservative supporters like the Koch brothers to really push this agenda nationally. So how important is it nationally?
I think it's very important nationally. One, I think you've identified, Scott, that this is an agenda from ALEC, A-L-E-C, and Republic governors across the country to push a national agenda against the middle-class worker and against labor and for corporate interest. What I think is interesting is that the response to it, the rally against it, and the defeat of it has been local, grassroots, and bipartisan in every state that has taken a stand against it. In Ohio, you saw the watershed of signatures. They needed 250,000 signatures. They got 1.3 million signatures to get the anti-worker, anti-union legislation on the ballot. In Wisconsin, we successfully recalled six senators. We kicked two of them out of office. We're going to successfully recall a governor and a lieutenant governor. Almost never been done in the history of our country. And in Michigan, you've seen local people take action. So while the legislation and the strategy in the first place is a national corporate interest strategy. The pushback against it, the revolution, this is a revolution. This is our spring awakening in the United States of America for middle-class workers, has in every state been grassroots, been nonpartisan, and been middle-class driven. And I think that's what has to happen, because otherwise we can't take back our local politics. So on the one hand, I hope that what we're doing in Wisconsin serves as a role model and a motivation to citizens of other states. But at the same time, we have to own this. This is the citizens of Wisconsin saying to corporate interests and to politicians like Scott Walker, this will not stand.
That was Lynn Freeman, a board member of the group United Wisconsin. Learn more about Wisconsin's recall campaign by visiting our website at btlonline.org. Palestinians under Israeli occupation experience many restrictions on their day-to-day lives, from lack of water and electricity to restrictions on movement to violence at the hands of Israeli settlers in the Israeli army. Outside Bethlehem, the Nasser family is struggling to hold on to its 100 hilltop acres, which the Israeli government is trying to seize to build more settlements, adding to those that already surround the Nasser farm. The family is working towards self-sufficiency on their farm they call Tent of Nations, as life grows ever more difficult for them and residents of the nearby village of Nahalin. Jihan Nasser lives on the hilltop with her family. She's trained in computer technology and 5 years ago set up a women's learning center in Nahalin. There, she and international volunteers offer computer training, English language courses, health education, and farming techniques to dozens of mostly young village women. On a recent trip to Israel, East Jerusalem, and the West Bank, Between the Lines' Melinda Tuhu spoke with Jihan Nasser about her work in the village, the challenges she's had to overcome, and the difficulties the women she trains still face.
We have volunteers who come here and teaches some of these classes. For example, I also teach computer classes. We have a computer lab. And for example, English classes, we have people coming from America, from UK, from Switzerland, from Germany. They come here, women, and they give those English classes. We have also art workshops. We do. We have so many interested women from all over the world who comes here. We have from Japan, we have from Sweden, we have from Switzerland again, Germany, USA. They come here, and from Italy, they come here and they also do, for example, art workshops with the women to produce like pieces of art, and maybe we can sell it somewhere to the people who comes and visit here, and sometimes in Bethlehem in the shops. We have also a group for embroidery. We do embroidery also with the women. The aim of this is to make those women independent, to be able to survive in those conditions in the village, bad conditions. Some of their fathers and brothers, they don't work, so there is no income coming to the house. So it's not easy for those girls to ask the mothers or the fathers for their needs. For example, one story that some of them, they can't, for example, afford to have pads for their periods. So, for example, you know, doing those workshops in art and embroidery, maybe it's good to sell those things, and for, you know, the income will come directly to them to support them and to be able to buy anything they want, you know, without asking the father or the brother.
The women here are all Muslim, right, in the class?
All of them are Muslims.
And that you're a Christian family,
right?
But you're all Palestinian.
Mm-hmm.
Was there any kind of tension or difficulty?
At the beginning, when I started 5 years ago, coming to a very conservative village was not easy. You know, I'm not wearing a veil like all of them, and I'm not Muslim. At the beginning, I had some difficulties. I don't want to say difficulties, but they asked me so many questions about me, my faith, about being a Palestinian Christian and how I pray and how many times and all these things. And I always said to them, look, I am Palestinian, I speak Arabic, and I live in Palestine. So I am like you guys, but my religion is different. So it's good also to give them an idea about my religion. It's always good to introduce them to our religion from that perspective in classes, not directly, you know.
So if they're here, I guess that means they don't have a problem with their fathers or husbands having them come here.
You know, at the beginning, we did have a problem. You know, usually the men used to ask. They used to call me and tell me, what are you doing in the village? What are these courses? Why you are doing these courses here, not in another village, you know? And what they are learning in the classes. And if they are convinced, they will register the wife or the sister. And if not, they will say, it's okay, you know. But it's good that they used to call me, the men, and tell me, please register my woman in this class or that class. But I also want to hear it from the women themselves, to be able to call or come to the center and tell me, I want to be in this class or that class. And I think it's now it's changing since 5 years, and I've been having so many people, I mean so many women coming by themselves with their kids coming here. And now I am famous in the village. They know, where are you going? I'm going to Jihan. They don't say, we are going to the women's center. They say, we are going to Jihan. So even the fathers and the brothers, they know Jihan. We focus every year on a different group of women. And since 2 years, since last year and this year, I decided to help those, let me call them desperate girls, who dropped out from school at very young age and they don't know what to do and where to go. And they are so desperate. We have every day, we have in the morning, we have a session for 1 hour. We talk about our problems. And it's really sad to hear those stories for those, you know, those problems for those young girls. I mean, sometimes, you know, I feel so upset and I go home and it's too upsetting, you know, and sometimes you don't know what to do. How to help. But as I said before, it's good to listen to them and to hear those problems. And sometimes it's good to give them, you know, encouragement and to lift their spirits up, you know, and to be patient and all of that. And I tell them always, just get out of the house, come here, meet us, and sometimes socialize and get to know other friends, get to know other women, hear another problem from another woman, and be, you know, together and, you know, back each other.
That was Jihan Nasir, who runs a women's center in the West Bank village of Nahalin. For more information on the women's center, visit our website at btlonline.org. You've been listening to Between the Lines, a weekly program presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. Between the Lines is produced and distributed by Squeaky Wheel Productions. If you have suggestions for topics and guests, please contact Between the Lines by writing us at mail@btlonline.org. Visit our website at btlonline.org, where you can hear our current and archive programs in MP3 and streaming audio, and subscribe to free weekly podcasts, program summaries, and interview transcripts. Follow us on Facebook at Between the Lines Radio News Magazine and on Twitter at BTL Radio News. Our theme music was written by Richard Hill and Jody Gray and performed by Mikata. This week's program was produced by Liz Becker, Hank Hoffman, Anna Manzo, Bob Nixon, Gary Trujillo, Melinda Tuhus, and Jeff Yates. For Between the Lines, I'm Scott Harris.